What's up, folks? Welcome to the Victor Cruz Acting Studio. I'm your host, Victor Cruz. And today's episode is a very special episode because I am in Los Angeles, literally in a car, while my guest is driving the car. Hopefully we won't get to any accidents, but he's a good friend. We went to SUNY Purchase College together. He's an amazing filmmaker. He's done a lot of amazing projects along the way. He's originally from Peru.
Boot, boot.
Moved out to... Now, did you move out to New York first? Because you came from Peru, and coming from Peru, you went straight to SUNY Purchase?
Yeah. Hi, guys. This is Christian. I
didn't properly introduce this man because we were going to get to that. This is my buddy, Christian Vincent. Welcome.
Hi, Victor. Hi, everybody.
You sound so formal when you say, hello, everyone. I love that.
Yeah. It's my accent. It makes everything sound formal and special. But yeah, I moved to New York after I finished my first bachelor's in Peru. And I spent like 6 months or a little bit more learning English. And then I went to SUNY Purchase where I met you.
Where we met each other.
Yeah.
So in 1 year, you learned how to speak English?
Kind of, yeah.
Well, that's kind of cool because a lot of people can't learn a second language or another language in a very short amount of time. How did you do that? I mean,
neat.
What was your process?
Just desperation, reading, watching TV, reading books and everything. Like my first job when I didn't fully spoke English yet was answering the phones for the Office of Student Affairs. I'd purchase.
I think I remember you working there.
And I did not understand anything that people say, but I eventually had to make it work.
You know, if I had not introduced you to everyone, some might say that I'm interviewing the great Walter Mercado. You remember that guy?
Of course.
Whenever he said something, how impactful was that for the Latino community? Because we really listened to him.
For a lot of people, like coming from South America, that's less strong. You know, that I think applies a lot to the people here.
Okay.
Like my mom, my aunt, didn't know much about him until they moved here. You know.
Now, did you know that he used to be an actor?
Oh, no, not at all.
Yeah, he started as an actor. He was in novelas, he was in films. If you actually look him up, you'll see that he had a resume.
Oh, wow.
Before. But I think he always had the gift. I think he, in an interview once, said that he had gotten the gift when he was about... at least discovered it when he was about 5 years old.
Whoa.
He had a dream. But yeah, he started out as an actor. And now you're a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And you found yourself... now you've gone from SUNY Purchase. You were in New York. And even after you graduated from SUNY Purchase, because you and I worked on a bunch of stuff together.
Yeah.
At what point did you move out to Los Angeles?
After SUNY, I worked production in New York for a year. And I went back to school for a master's, which took me 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And around that time, after finishing my master's, I came to LA. Back then, Malcolm, our mm-hmm. friend, Malcolm Goodwin, he was going to shoot a movie and he asked me to help him.
Okay.
So he asked me to come and help him. And he basically hooked me up with a bunch of stuff. So I came. The project didn't happen right away mm-hmm. because this was... 2007, early 2008, and the economic meltdown happened. So his project got postponed, and so I just stayed in LA, waiting for his project to happen, and I just ended up doing my own thing.
Now, before you came out to Los Angeles, you were already making films in New York City, even while you were at Purchase and after. I guess you could... at what point in your life did you decide, I think I want to make films? Maybe that's way before Purchase.
Yeah, that's way before Purchase. I originally wanted to be a writer because my thing was storytelling. And I figure most writers, most successful writers have been journalists. Mm-hmm. So I should study journalism. So back in Peru, I went to study communication, which was the discipline that encompassed journalism, or where they teach you journalism. And I met a couple of friends who were doing audiovisual work, which is, this is in the 90s. So
this is audiovisual stuff.
Yeah, through. This is the 90s. So okay. They're just getting your hands on a camera. It's like a big deal. It was a big deal, right? Especially in Peru. So only rich people were able to get like a camera. So we got they just like made it happen. They will just come up with their stories and try to make it work. And that was another specialty in communications. It was one was journalism, the other one was audiovisual, and mm-hmm. there was a third one which was organizational. But anyways, but like I met these people, and then I started working with them, and that's when I realized that's the type of storytelling I was really into, which in many ways was a horrible thing because it was more like a curse and a disease. That has never left me. It can be very fulfilling, but it's very taxing in the sense that it's like an obsession. You cannot escape it. I've tried to quit for many years, many times, and you just can't. It always comes back. Like you're like trying to start a whole new career, and then this is the idea of a story, and before you know it, you're spending your nights after work typing the story and developing the story, and then you just know you need money to shoot it and rally people, and then it's just like you quit your job because you don't give a damn about your job because all that matters is making this movie that is like so vivid in your mind, and then that's yeah.
When you think of like when you think of the words, you know, disease and a curse, you know, you think of a negative thing. It sounds negative or it sounds painful, but in this, for me, it sounds like you connected with what your journey was, what your purpose was early on, and you know it's the thing that you're supposed to be doing because you can't stop thinking about it. It's in your blood.
Of course, yeah. Like when I say a disease or a curse, I'm referring to the aspect of being unavoidable, than being like a viral, you know, that it gets into you and there is no way to take it out. That's it.
Got it.
That's what I refer.
Gotcha.
I do use those words because there is a little bit of a negative implication, in the sense of, is weird to know exactly what you want to do. It's weird to see your path in front of you at a young age, because you just start moving in that direction, and you see everybody else just floating like butterflies, exploring different things, and you just wonder, you know, wow, that looks like fun. Or, you know, that other thing looks like fun. Or what if I did this other, you know, this other art or this other job or whatever? And people who don't have that clarity, they can just jump and forth between different, and try different things in life. Mm. So, and that's, you know, the grass is always greener in the other side. It's because you know your path, mm-hmm. so you can see your path so clearly. It just makes sense to wonder how it would be to not be on that path. How it would be to just be waking up every morning without knowing what the heck you want to do, and then just like start exploring or whatever. So I say that's why I use the words curse and disease, because just like everything, you know, when you end up on one extreme, on one side of the equation, you always wonder how it would be on the other side, right? Because you can't tell. You will never know.
So you try quitting.
Many times.
You try quitting, and it just kept showing up and saying, hey, Christian, this is what we got to do.
Yeah, like until some time ago, I was doing at least a movie a year. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, all my time, all my money, everything was just like into just making projects and making movies, and it's not even like it doesn't say anything, you just do it. It's like being hungry and going to eat. It just happens. It's unavoidable. There is no thinking. It's just it, you know. You start having ideas and you just know what to do, so you just do it.
What's the most you've spent on, because it seems like you fund your own projects.
Yeah.
What was the most you spent on any one of your projects?
The most was a short film I made, which was actually my senior project, The Coronel.
Mm-hmm.
I spent
Ray Valentin was in it.
Yeah,
another one of our friends.
I spent over $40,000 on that one.
$40,000.
Yeah.
Now, knowing what you know today, as a filmmaker, was that a lot of money for you back then? Do you think that you could have spent less, or was that the amount of money you needed to spend at that time based on what equipment was available to you, or how would you have done it differently today?
A lot of the money went into buying film. I mean, this is actual film, 16 millimeter, Super 16. We shot Super 16.
Got it.
So that's like, you're talking about $400 per every 10 minutes.
Hmm.
And I just, because it was my senior project, and in my arrogance, I thought I already mastered the craft. I decided to go all out and get in debt in order to, if I'm going to spend 10, 15 grand in, or more into like costumes and like locations and everything else to look good, it would be silly to hold back and not to spend the money in buying film to be able to keep on shooting over and over until we capture everything, because there will be no coming back. There will not be a chance to come back and reshoot if something goes wrong. So within, I understand that logic. I think the main point the main point was just the arrogance, thinking that project was gonna like blow up and get me somewhere. Mm-hmm. That was the main, because other than that, it was not. Nowadays, it's very easy. You can just like rent a video camera and shoot for less money. Mm-hmm. You know, like even if you shoot with a Red or whatever. God, now you can get 4K for like almost nothing. But back then, that was the only way to get a high quality image, was shooting film.
Got it.
So yeah.
And so doing that project, what did you take away from that project now? That you're, I mean, because obviously that wasn't your last project. That would just happen to be your senior project in school.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back on it, what did you learn from that project that you can definitely apply to some of the stuff you're doing today?
There is a lot of things. Every project taught me something very specific, especially because I always approach the process with a system, like trying to identify the parts and everything.
Mm-hmm.
One of the many things I learned in that project was that, my approach was correct in the sense of if you are going to invest certain money or something on something, the investment has to be proportional. You know, like if you're going to invest on like, let's say, outfits and locations, then it would be dumb to not invest in equipment, because you need those to look their best.
Right.
And once you are investing in equipment, then you need to invest in crew. Because what better way to use that equipment than professional people who can use it effectively and efficiently, and so on, you know, like, that's one of the many things I learned in that. But like, I think one of the biggest lessons I got from it was, you do need to be clear about the story, and what you're trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
so being clear with your story is number one.
Yes, because and why you're trying to tell that story? Why you're trying to share that story? Because everything will revolve around that.
Mm-hmm.
If you are not clear in what you're trying to say, then chances are that you're just wasting your time. Unless, I mean, you're consciously learning, right? Like, if you understand, hey, I'm still learning, and this is one of the stories I have to shoot as my learning process, is great. But you need to understand, have that clarity, and like, because once you have the clarity and the story is incredibly clear and what you're trying to say is incredibly clear, then you don't need it to look good. It doesn't need high production value, because that's the production value is the easiest thing. You just get money and buy production value. You just hire the best DP with the best crew with the best equipment, and it's gonna look like a $100 million movie.
Right.
But and that's another thing I learned, because the film looks so good, people's expectations on the film were incredibly high.
Mm-hmm.
And then the story did not deliver. So had the film looked a little bit more
grittier,
cheaper, mm-hmm. clumsier, then people's expectations would have been lower, which means probably they would have been more willing to accept the story for what it was. But the film looked great, and as soon as you see the first frame, people's expectations were like, wow, this is a real movie. And it wasn't, because I didn't know, I wasn't that good. I didn't know enough how to tell a story to deliver.
So would you say that you had a lot of technical knowledge, you knew how to execute a film, but mm-hmm. when it came to story, did you find that wasn't necessarily your strongest point at that time?
Yeah, it still isn't. And that's the hardest part of the craft, because it's subjective and intangible. So that's the part that nobody can really teach you correctly. Mm-hmm. There is no technique to teach you this, because it's a matter of sensitivity and how your brain is wired. People can teach you how to frame, people can teach you how to set up lights, how to record sound, but only you have to figure out how to tell the story you want to tell.
Gotcha. Now, would you say, does it matter what kind of camera you're using to shoot a film? Does it matter that you use this technology versus another? Like, or does it just come back to story?
That's a multi-level question, because you obviously need the technical part. If you're doing professionally, you know, the camera you're going to choose has to do with the delivery you're going to... like, in what platform is going to be distributed, your project, mm-hmm. you know? Like, because if it's going to be for YouTube, maybe you can get away with a simpler camera. If this is going to have a theatrical distribution, then you probably need to go with a better camera. In a personal way, I think it becomes less relevant, because you can just look at the history of film mm-hmm. and then realize at the end it all boils down to story, you know. Lars von Trier, when he did The Celebration and he did the whole Dogma 95, and when he started the Dogma 95 movement, he just proved it, because in theory he shot SD, and the story is so compelling you just don't care. Like, after a minute you just accept that's what the movie is going to look like, and you just move on.
Now, what is this Dogma approach, for some people that don't know?
Oh, that's in the 90s there was this he's still around, he's a big filmmaker, Lars von Trier. He and other filmmakers came out with a manifesto, and it was the year 95, that's why it's called Dogma 95, in which, like, they said that the only important thing was the story and the delivery of the story. So in their manifesto they said they will only make movies based around the performance of the actors. They wouldn't have fancy lighting, and they wouldn't have fancy camera movements. It would just be the raw delivery of the actor's performance with a simple video camera. And he made The Celebration, and he released, or they released the manifesto when they sent The Celebration, which is the movie they made, to Cannes. And that was a little bit explaining the movie, because the movie in theory had been shot like that. Mm-hmm. And the movie is a great film, you know. And like I said, it's like after a couple of minutes, you accept the movie is going to look the way it looks. And you just don't care, because you're so focused on the story.
Right. Got some music playing there?
Yeah, it was automatic.
It was like a love song that started playing.
Yeah, it's accomplices.
It's cool. We already know each other. You don't have to
we don't hold hands.
You don't have to woo me.
Yeah.
Or hold my hand while we do this interview.
Well, but I want to. Please,
okay, fine.
Me.
You got it. So now, moving into your process as a director, you obviously, you know, you have story, you have how you're going to execute this thing, but now you're going to cast the actors. Mm-hmm. What was your process like overall with some of your films? Like, how did you cast your actors?
My casting approach is very difficult on the actors. Mm-hmm. It's very different and confusing for the actors.
How so?
Because for me, like, my expectations on the actors are very high, in the sense of I know I am not big enough to write and come up with every single detail of the story and the characters. And so I only have the basic spine of the story and the basic beats that need to happen. Mm-hmm. And then I expect the actors to fill in everything else about the character. And, you know, we hopefully do it together. But I do expect them to create all the character on their own.
Right.
As long as they deliver what I ask them to deliver. And then when I do the casting, when I do the auditions, what I'm looking for is emotional intelligence. So I will deliver, you know, the actors will come
to the
side.
What is that emotional intelligence?
It's being able to, in a way, it's just empathy, to understand how people think and feel and how to replicate it, in the sense of they will read the script and they can figure it out, okay, this is what the character is feeling and this is why the character is doing what he's doing and this is what they're trying to accomplish in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Because many actors, they just kind of like deliver, you know, oh, this looks like tension and they start screaming, oh, this looks like sad and they start crying, and it's just like people are way more complex than that, and being able to have that emotional intelligence to understand the nuances of the emotions and feelings is key. So then, because that's what I'm pursuing, I will, whenever I will have the auditions and I have somebody that I think have it in them, because I like the way they deliver the lines, because they can deliver the lines beautifully for that one scene, but that doesn't mean they will be able to deliver the whole movie. And so I need to find out if they understand, because again, I cannot hold them. I cannot be holding their hands. I expect them to just do a lot of the heavy lifting on their own. So I need to know if they have it in them. So then basically my first thing is to just test for the range of the emotional intelligence. So then I will be able to be, okay, that scene, it was great. Now, let's imagine that your character is sad or heartbroken because his mom just died. So now say, let's do the same scene with that in mind. And they will do it, and then I will be like, well, now let's do that your character is extremely happy. He just had his firstborn. And obviously those are such completely context. And the actors, because that's the interesting thing, is like most actors will get frustrated because they don't see the point, because they just want the answer. They want me to tell them, jump and smile, and they want to jump and smile, and I'll be, yes, that's it, perfect, you did it. And
so you require a lot more from the
and
actor.
I don't care about the answer, because that's the whole point, is for me, is the process.
Mm-hmm.
If I said jump and laugh, and you end up like rolling and like rolling on the floor and crying, but if you understand where you're coming from or why you're doing it, you may be solving a problem I didn't know I have. And that's my point, is like, because the actor may do that, like I said, instead of just I expect one answer, instead of that they just come with their own, I may realize I was getting the story wrong and the actors are clearer on the story than I am.
So
does that make sense?
Yeah, it's for you, your approach is very much a collaborative effort.
In many ways,
because
yes.
you show up to do your work.
Yep.
Your heavy lifting, and you want the actors to also do some heavy lifting.
Of course.
On
yeah.
their end, and in a sense, the two of you together solve problems.
Yes.
You're each other's solution, in a sense.
Absolutely. And this is a very simple duh moment, right? Screenwriters and actors can get paid fortunes for doing what they do.
Right.
And actors don't get paid that much money for having a pretty face. They get paid a lot of money for being able to do that heavy lifting. If you're going to do that heavy lifting, then you're probably not adding much to the project. And which means you're replaceable. You're dispensable. And it sounds horrible, but think about that. It's like, would you spend $100 million getting somebody who is just like anybody?
Now, that's a good point that you make, because then you think about certain projects that are made and where maybe the actor is not doing as much heavy lifting, but because they are a particular person
mm-hmm.
that might help sell the project.
Absolutely.
Might be a good business choice in that world for them. They'll be okay with that.
Absolutely. I mean, some people just have sex appeal, and that's, you know, they do, that's all they need to sell. But again, can you just count on that all the time? You know, it's like you're going to a party and I tell you, hey, why don't you take this extra $100 just in case? You may not need them,
mm-hmm.
But again, just in case.
Just in case.
You know, and it's the same idea. You know, it's like, you don't have to do the heavy lifting. You don't have to analyze the script. Maybe you have an arrogant director who doesn't want you to think, who just wants you like a puppet to just jump and cry at command. And that's why they're going to pay you. Or, I mean, and you have to be professional and just do it because that's your job, right? Just be professional. And this is not a collaborative type of director. So shut up and work. Do your job like any other professional. And that can work. But then again, what happens if, you know, you end up in a, with a, the project is successful, you get a lot of attention, and then the good directors who want to collaborate expect you to do the heavy lifting, and you're not ready.
So in other words, you might develop some bad habits. Then you come along to a director that requires what you require, which in a sense is not that you're saying, let the actor do heavy lifting on their own, let them do the work.
No.
You're saying, let's collaborate. We're all lifting together here, and you're going to help me solve something.
Yes.
You know, and to your point, you know, I've heard stories where even someone like Alfred Hitchcock, who was a big-time director in the Hollywood world, he would give directions, and sometimes almost to the point where he wanted the actor to do it an exact way, and for them it wasn't organic, it wasn't necessarily real, and they'd question him and they'd say, but I don't think my character would do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or they'd say, why would my character do that? And then Hitchcock would respond by saying, because I say it so.
Of course, I mean, you have many things going on there again. First of all, you have directors that are very visual. And they just really need you there like a model or you know. But if the whole project is geared towards that direction, they probably don't need you to deliver that much performance. You know, and if it's the type of project, then obviously that's it. And again, everybody you're going to work with is different. So again, that's why you want to have the range. That's why it's called a range. Because you can move within that range from being just a silent model to this incredibly deep character that only you can create. And you can just move back and forth as needed, depending who you're working with and the type of project that you need. Because you might be, I mean, like what? Let's say any actor, George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Ryan Gosling, and they just hire you for a watch commercial, and they just need you to just be good looking and smile, showing the watch in your wrist. And I mean, yeah, you're like a great actor, and you're not gonna turn around and like, hey, what's my motivation? You know, it's like, dude, it's just a commercial, just pose, right? That's why it's called range. You know, like that actor in that moment, he probably could just do a million other things, but it's not required for that project in that moment. But if something changed, they could deliver.
Got it. So I understand. You're saying when an actor has range, they know when to use certain things for certain types of projects.
Exactly.
And what's required of them. And then whatever's required of them, they can produce
it. It's available. Exactly.
It's available to
them.
It's
a toolbox that they carry. It's a tool belt with all the tools they need is there. They may not use any of them, but if something happens and they needed them, they have them on the belt.
How important is training for an actor? Do you think it's something that should an actor go to acting school? Should they study acting? Is it required?
That's a heavy question.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to answer it because my first instinct is yes, but it depends how you understand it. Because what I think, and this goes linked to what we were talking about earlier about emotional awareness, emotional intelligence. Like, what I would go for is consciousness. Because that's how you develop your emotional intelligence. Like, whenever you walk into a room and you see people, you just wonder why people are doing what they are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And basically that's like flexing. Just like lifting weights. Like every time you go into a room, you're wondering, oh, why are these people dressed like this? Why are these people talking like this? And then you can come up with guesses. And as the day goes on, some of those guesses will be validated as correct. Some will be completely wrong. But you will learn and you just keep on going. And then your guesses will be more accurate. So you can go to school and develop that through certain structures. If that's how your mind works, maybe school will not help you if that's not how your mind works.
Mm-hmm.
But you do need some consciousness, some awareness of constantly doing thinking. and trying to understand people and emotions. So, like I said, it doesn't have to be like going to school. School is like a kind of like a good starting point. But the one thing for sure is that it's not going to work is just sitting on your ass and just waiting that like your cute smile is going to carry over and over, because that might work once, and if you're lucky, twice. But that's about it.
I like the two, you make two really great points. I mean, you make great points all around, but the two points you really made great were, you know, one is to be conscious, be aware.
Yeah.
And through that consciousness and awareness, you start to absorb and add to that toolbox, to that emotional intelligence.
Yes.
Empathy, understanding different types of people, different types of journeys. I think that's so great. And the other thing you said, which was really awesome, is that, you know, I'm totally paraphrasing what you just said, but it's like going to an institution or going to a school that understands how to work with you. Because what I find sometimes with certain schools or institutions is that you go and you actually have this natural, raw greatness,
talent,
that
yeah.
sometimes talent that that sometimes can be stifled or almost
by the wrong
altered, yes. in a way that you lose that.
Yep, absolutely.
You lose your confidence, and I think you're right by saying you have to find the right place in which you can build further that talent, not take away.
But I would add something that I noticed. Back in Purchase, the film department, which was very small, was we used to share the building with the music department. Mm-hmm. And I noticed something that I noticed that you can apply to all the arts in many ways. And it's like this. If you have a gift or a talent, let's say playing the violin, mm-hmm. or playing the piano, you took some classes, you learned to play, and you play really, really well. Maybe like you listen to a song on the radio and you can just play it by ear. You're great, right? Mm-hmm. And you decide, wow, I'm a natural born musician. I'm going to go to music school to go better. And I noticed something that happened really quick. Once people started to formalize their knowledge, mm-hmm. they would lose all their power. Mm-hmm. So by the end of their freshman year and like during the sophomore year, everybody sucked. And because they were trying to label and organize all the data they always do organically. It's like you know how to cook, but then when they tell you to start cooking with measuring cups and like with a clock and timing, and like then you're just thrown out because it's like stopping your thinking. It's like it's distracting you, it's annoying you. So many people will get there and they will be so frustrated and think what, like you said, it's like, oh, this is stifling me, this is wrong, and this is destroying me, and they will quit. And that was the biggest mistake they've ever did. Because they walked away with it's like pulling a cake half-baked. Mm-hmm. It cannot go back to being flour.
Right.
And it's still not a cake.
Hmm.
So and then the people who push through and learn to systematize all the knowledge and then they caught up with their previous experience and then they moved on forward, they have an incredible advantage because they were not only back to where they started, they were so much further along, but most importantly, they were able to systematize the future learning. They will become like, because they will just be improving. So that's a very, it is some, for some people, going to school, because it depends on your teacher and your professor and all those things, can be a terrible thing. And I'm not talking about like I'm in the other example that I mentioned, that it was like, oh, in the middle of the process. Some, you know, if you have a crazy guy who just yells at you, that's not going to help you. Yeah, and you probably want to like go leave and find somebody else to help you. But it is part of the process to start losing your gift. Mm. So you have to, again, consciously and aware, be aware of that process and decide if you should stick to it or not. If the gift is really in you, you probably will never lose it. You shouldn't doubt. You know, if you wanna, again, if you think the process is not working for you, move on, look for other guidance. And keep on exploring. but don't abandon the process completely. Mm-hmm. Like, don't just if, like, let's say you go to school, it doesn't work for you, don't just quit. Go to another school. Go for another teacher. Keep on looking, keep on exploring, keep on working and developing. Because again, the only thing that doesn't work is sitting on your butt.
I think that's great that you share this, like, don't quit, don't give up, because, and I like the idea that you actually go back to that raw talent that you actually came in with, but you might have acquired a system in which to absorb knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not to say that every single thing you're going to learn is going to work, yep. You know, and we got to be, you know, real with that. Like, it's just not the case. But I love the fact that you say, look, don't quit. And if that's not the place for you, find another place. Mm-hmm. And just keep searching, but never quit on yourself. Because how many people that it's actually their journey to be an actor or to mm-hmm. be a filmmaker, musician, whatever it is, and they just stop and they quit.
Yeah.
It's a wasted journey.
Well, if they stopped and quit, it probably wasn't their journey. And we go back to the beginning of the conversation when we were talking about the curse and the disease. Mm-hmm. If it's your journey, you don't need to push until you get a hernia. It's going to happen. You won't be able to help keep on going. And if you quit and you just find happiness in something else, more power to you. Mm-hmm. It wasn't your journey. Just keep on doing your personal journey to figure out what makes you happy. Because at the end, if you ask me, I don't measure the success of people for what they achieved, but how happy they are. If you came and told me, wow, I'm the most famous actor and I appear in all the magazines, I could care less. Mm. If you show up with your two beautiful kids and tell me, wow, I'm so happy, I just want to spend the rest of my life playing with my children, I will envy the hell out of you because you're happy. Mm. And that is the only thing that matters in life. So I'm within that logic. How much energy and how much sacrifice you put into pursuing your path and your career should be proportional to how much you like it and enjoy it. Because if you don't enjoy it, don't do it. If you can quit, then quit. You know, because again, it might not be for you. And that's totally fine. You just have to keep on exploring to find the thing that is for you, that makes you happy. And if you find out that you want to quit and you cannot quit, then just, like we were saying, keep on looking for people to help you how to keep on developing until you can, you know, just come to terms with your passion.
And can I ask you, like, for you, in your life, did you always feel like this? Or at some point in your life, were you, like everyone else, kind of looking outward for that worldly success? And at some point, something happened where you said, you know what, that stuff's not important.
That's a great question. I could lie and say I never had it. I think when I was younger, I did have it. It was part of the motivation because I had very little experience. Mm-hmm. So I had to borrow other people's experience to have a context to mine. And in that process, I would be, oh my God, I'm not as good as this other filmmaker or this other person. I will say, oh, that person is rich and famous. I am not rich and famous, therefore I'm not there yet. Mm-hmm. But that, in time, I realized is because I lacked my own experience in my own path. Mm-hmm. And as I kept on making more films, I started caring less and less of other people because the film just didn't come out the way I wanted. And then I realized I don't care if everybody else loves it. That's a different conversation that we can come back to, but that's how I started thinking, as long as I want it. So it's like if other people declaring me successful meant nothing because I didn't feel, I wasn't happy with what I was getting.
Got it.
You know, so that's kind of like where my logic where my logic comes from. And that's another something, because I also started to learn that that's another measure of success. Like, I don't think any of my projects has been like that great or good or whatever. Many people can say they were crap, and it's fine. But the one thing that I learned, and going back about how much to care about what other people think, is that, like, after my films have been to film festivals, there has always been one or two people that came after, and they thanked me for one or two details in the film that spoke to them in a personal level, and that helped them feel validated or simply just understood. And that was so much more fulfilling than having a big box office or a big award or whatever. Just like touching someone in a meaningful way was way more powerful and minimal. So, and that for me becomes part of the happiness of creating films. Mm-hmm. Just that knowing that there are other people out there like me that I can help. I can do for them what other people have done for me, even if it's just two or three. That makes it worth it, because I personally don't believe in entertainment, in the entertainment business. There is no such a thing as entertainment business. It's a much bigger, films have a much bigger social role. Anyways, I could keep on going, but that's the idea.
No, I think, you know, everything that you're sharing right now is truly such a beautiful thing on so many levels, because I know for me, even myself, I was in a place once where I felt like if I was successful out there, then that meant that I was worth something. But I never checked in at that time to ask myself, was I happy with what I was doing? Was I enjoying the process? Now, I've been dreaming since I'm a kid that I want to do this. But I spent a lot of time in pain and not enjoying myself, because I was always trying to get into a club, some house, some circle of people, be accepted. And if they accepted me, whew, I made it. If I was making the big bucks, like you were saying earlier, I made it. But was I happy? Even thinking that way, I was not happy. So I love your perspective and where you come from and how you operate, because it's so, so encouraging and inspiring to so many people. I feel like you should teach a class, and I mean this sincerely, you should teach a class on filmmaking from that place. Like, I could see you as a teacher teaching film, but coming from that place first, then suddenly your approach would be different.
I'd be hitting all the students with a stick. You're not doing it right. Not like that. Do it my way.
No, but that's the technical aspect, because you're such a technical guy. And that's a whole other conversation. When it comes to technical stuff, you were always the man. Especially in our circle of friends, like, you were the guy. You knew how things should be when it came to, like, measurements, right? This has to go here, from here to there. That's how it's got to be. But in regards to this approach of not getting caught up into the world, I think you'd make an excellent teacher if you were a teacher of film, of filmmaking.
I think, like many things in life, that is one thing that you cannot teach. Like, I'm sure people who are listening to this have heard this a million times, and they've been told this a million times, about just like focus on being happy, and it just simply went through them, because it's something that only hits you when you are ready. And so it's not something that people can teach you. It's like, it's something that you will look for when you are ready to live it. You will start looking for it, and you may not be able to articulate it, but you may be living it without knowing it. But again, it's like, very often it's not something that people can give you. You have to earn it by, again, consciousness. Keep on looking and keep on growing and keep on asking yourself, you know, why is this going on? Why are people doing what they're doing? And try to empathize with people and understand why they do things. Trying to understand the role that every person plays in the world, because that eventually helps you understand your role. And you also, after exploring all these other worlds that people have in your imagination, you just start like figuring out what does it for you and what it doesn't do it for you. What makes you happy and what doesn't make you happy. And again, it's like, I cannot tell you what makes you happy. Maybe like you want to put on a tutu and start dancing ballet on a corner to please other people, and that's fine.
Now, is this what you do out here in Los Angeles?
At night.
At night.
But like, no, and that kind of thing is like, and nobody can tell you that. You just have to try it. And that's it, you know, and you just keep on trying things until you figure out this is what does it for me, and I don't care about anything else. I don't care about like having money or fame or fans or how many views I have in YouTube. You just go and do what makes you happy, even if nobody else knows it, because it's a private thing. Happiness is private. Nobody needs to know that you're happy or not. You may want to share it with some people, your friends, your family, whatever, but you don't have to. It's yours. And if it's real, nobody can take it away. And very often you find it in the smallest things. You know, like playing with your child or just making a little movie with a couple of friends.
Hey, Christian, that was beautiful. I think we're going to end it on that.
Okay.
Such a beautiful thing. Thank you so much for doing this. We're literally driving out here, and always great to reconnect with friends, and Cristiano is one of those people that I consider family. So thank you so much for doing my podcast, my brother.
Thank you, man. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, for sure. This is a great interview. All right, folks, stay with us. Continue listening to our podcast. Share them with your friends and family. Follow me at Victor Cruz Acting Studio on Instagram, and I'll talk to you guys real soon. Peace.